Thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah, thank you. I need it. Hi, everybody. My name is Harold Fox, and I'm an alcoholic. Truly, by the grace of a loving God and a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink today. Speak into the mic. See, they got directions up here. My wife's been giving me directions for 48 hours up here about what I should say, what I can't say, what I may say, what I probably shouldn't say. And, of course, I've been reading the book, and it says that we alcoholics are undisciplined people. So I'm going to tell you whatever the hell I want, and I'll deal with her later on. Let me tell you how sick she is. She came to Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years and then went to Al-Anon. So either that or it shows you how sick I am. I'm not real sure. But anyway, I need to tell you that I have a home group. It's called the Meat and Potatoes Group. I have a sobriety date. It's the 26th of May, 1990. I have a sponsor. His name is Jim B., and he has a sponsor. His name is Frank S. I think those are the things that I need to maintain to have good membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think I want to thank Patrick for inviting me to come out here until I realized that I'm speaking on April Fool's Day. That kind of threw me for a moment. Of course, I come from Southern California. That's kind of, you know, that's where the granola AA is, just the fruits, the nuts, and the flakes get out to speak. And Hogan will be on tomorrow, so I'll give you guys a shot at him. So anyway, I came up on Thursday, and when I'm going to go to out-of-town meetings, I've been afforded the privilege to be able to not have to work if I don't want to, so I can get away a day early, stay a day late, and I always like to come to town a day early just to meet with the local people and go to the local meetings. And I got to come in Thursday night and meet with some of the folks, and we went and had dinner and went to a little candlelight meeting here in town called A Breath of Fresh Air, which was just a lot of fun. But I was watching the news, and I just got the biggest kick out of it, and I thought, there's got to be a lot of alcoholics up here in this area, because on the news, there was a deal about, I guess you guys have got a jail up here that's five stories high. Maybe it's in Fresno, Visalia, I don't know, but it's in this area. And on the news, they talked about a guy had got drilled a little hole somehow in one of these bulletproof glass windows in the jail, got his sheets undone, got string, fed the string down five stories, and a guy tied on straws, and in one straw was pot, and one straw was cocaine, and one straw was tobacco. And I thought, well, hell, if they'd have put Tanqueray in there, they'd had all the basic food groups. That just cracked me up. I just thought that was absolutely hysterical to see that. You know, I mean, and they just now are discovering this, and I'm thinking, I wonder how long this has been going on. You know, I wanted to get up and ask that this afternoon at one of the panels, but I thought they may lock me up, so... And what else do I want to say before I really, really get started here? A couple things. I'm very, very emotional tonight. And so if it just seems like I'm emotional, it's because I am. Message of Alcoholics Anonymous was brought to me while I was in an institution in a little 30-day spin drive thing. And people like you came in every single night and brought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in. And because of that, I got the message of hope, and I've stayed sober ever since I left that institution. And we go out and we do this kind of work, and all you guys do it, that's why you're here tonight. You're all a bunch of service junkies, and that's why you're my people. But sometimes we feel so helpless when we go because they diss us and they want to throw stuff at us. But you need to know that some of us, like Mike, like myself, have heard what you guys had to bring in, and for that I am just eternally grateful. The other thing I want to tell you is that the fellow that did your invocation this evening, Ivan, we form bonds in Alcoholics Anonymous when you come here with people. Bonds that we'd never, ever, ever form anywhere else. And when I was fairly new sober, I got sent on a job assignment up here to do a job in Porterville at a Mervyn store. And so I was told that whenever I was going to work out of town anywhere or go anywhere, that I was to contact Alcoholics Anonymous before I left town, find out where there was a meeting, find out what street it was on, find out what time it was, so that I had a place to be after work and I didn't have to go through any panic. I may not go to the meeting, but at least I knew where it was, so I had no excuse. And so when I came up here, I called your central office. They told me there was a meeting at a church in Tulare, over on Tulare Avenue, I believe. And I walked into that meeting like I was taught to do in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught that you belong to the 2020 Club here, and you come 20 minutes early, and you stay 20 minutes late. And I walked into that meeting 20 minutes early, and Ivan and his wife Peggy were standing there. And for the next 9 nights, I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Corcoran and Lemoore and Visalia and Tulare and Porterville, and I don't know where all we went. I just know I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this man right here took me. You know, those of us that do the thing, there's two kinds of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe. There's the you bets and there's the yeah buts. And there's a whole bunch of you bets sitting out here. When we get asked, you just say, you bet. Somebody asked me the other day down south, why would you go to Visalia to speak at an AA meeting? I said, because I can. If they'd had a new kind of wine in Visalia, I'd have been up here. You can take it that down on it in a heartbeat, I'd have been here. And between what Ivan and his wife, they have 78 years of sobriety, and I may not impress very many people. It impresses the hell out of me. And I'm grateful to the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. Really grateful to the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish that more of them would attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They've gotten, and we're not supposed to share opinions up here, so I'll just do mine real early. Old-timers in my area have quit going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because they've gotten tired of the things that go on in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not going to talk about somebody smoking a joint or something like that. In my home group, which I used to think was the best home group in the world, one of the things that seems to be whatever the word is, a lot of it going on, is we're talking about mental illness in there now, about bipolar disease and about paranoid schizophrenia, and that's important stuff. But it doesn't belong in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It belongs where our book tells us, with a doctor. God gave us lots of good doctors and lawyers and all kinds of such folk to go out and get these other items taken care of. But we need to have our old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous to teach us about what alcoholism is and what we need to do about it. Those of you that if you guys weren't here for the early bird meeting yesterday and didn't hear Bob, you see, he told the most simple story about chickens and ducks. And Bob, I'm a duck. And if you weren't here to hear it, you have to ask Bob after the meeting or buy the tape. But I'm telling you, we need more guys in here keeping this thing simple. There's so much stuff goes on. If they didn't read the preamble in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't know what the hell I was in sometimes. And I go to a lot of meetings. There's another thing that I hear a lot of people sharing too. They say, meeting makers make it. No, I don't think so. I know a lot of meeting makers that are going to meetings and staying drunk. They're just going to meetings and drinking because they're not taking any action. And action has always been the magic word in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't think that's changed since the day I walked in here. I hear about 90 meetings in 90 days. Yeah, and I heard, and I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. But I don't think that's what keeps me sober. I think what we need to do in here, and then I'll get off my soapbox after I finish this, hopefully, is we need to put people back in the doctor's opinion and talk to them about what alcoholism is. First things first. And then I think as we read through the book with them and we start Bill's story and we go over to There Is a Solution and more about alcoholism and the chapter of the agnostics, we take them to the back and read the spiritual experience with them so they can understand that this thing's about one thing, change. Now, my wife gives me a bad time, but she would tell you that I'm a changed man, and the man that's standing here tonight is not the man that walked into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1990. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous every fiber of my body. And there's a guy wandering over there about to go out and have a cigarette right now, and I'm not going to take his inventory tonight from the podium. He and I do it pretty frequently, but I have heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and Matt is one of them. And I hope that doesn't go to his head, but there are people that are tireless workers here in AA, and he's one of them, and I admire him so much for what he's done. He calls me a newcomer, and as I've went around and kind of looked around at all the speakers and everything, I realized that I have less time than any of your speakers this weekend, so yes, I'm the newcomer. And what I found out, I used to call Matt on my birthday every year. On my 7-year birthday, I called and I said, I'm 7 now. He goes, okay, newcomer. And then I'd call him on my 8-year birthday and he goes, okay, newcomer. Finally, on my 10, I said, Matt, I'm at double digits now. I'm 10 years sober. And he goes, you're still up. newcomer. You know what I know about being a newcomer? If I stay new tonight, I'll stay teachable. That's the most important thing I can do. Some of us get a closed mind. Man, mine will slam shut like a steel trap sometimes when I get places. And it talks in our book about some of these we balked. All of these I have balked at somewhere along the line. And we talked about, Marion or somebody talked about hitting some bridges in sobriety, about being 7 years sober and hitting a bridge and then being 13 years sober. I don't remember who it was that shared today, but or yesterday, but it was, we hit those kind of things. And that's happened to me in the past. And God, you guys have had great speakers for this conference. I'm telling you, Bob was just awesome. And you were, honey, you know you were awesome. And Mike, I call him honey, too. He'll do a great job for you in the morning. Best of my remembrance, I drank probably alcohol the first time when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And I'm a guy that likes rewards for the things that I do. And I would go out and help my dad mow the lawn, and he used to drink the Schlitz beer. And we used to... Well, I won't say the thing we used to say about Schlitz, but anyway, he would give me a few sips of that Schlitz beer, and I don't know that I ever got drunk, but I know that I liked the effect it produced. If nothing else, it made me feel part of, and I was part of being with Dad, and we were, you know, we had a bond. Alcohol helped me form bonds with people. When we read the promises in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of times, people don't like it, so now, when I do it, so I say it under my breath, but I always add the words, when I drink alcohol, in front of each one of those promises, so that I can see that I need to replace alcohol with something else, and I replace it with membership in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I drink alcohol, I intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. When I drink alcohol, fear of people and economic insecurity leave me. Honest. And every one of those promises would come true for me when I drink alcohol. And when I quit drinking alcohol, that's when I have my problems. I call it my anti-Herald medication. When you take my anti-Herald medication away from me, I'm screwed. Absolutely. And you want it, and if you're an alcoholic of my type, I suggest you don't drink for 2 weeks and see how you feel. Man, they told me, they said, you'll feel better when you quit drinking. And I did. I felt more anger, shame, rage, remorse, self-pity, and guilt than anything. And so I loved everything that alcohol ever did for me. But I need to tell you, when I was a little tiny kid, and I didn't know this until I was a grown man, my mother dressed me up like a girl until I was almost 2 years old because she always wanted to have a girl. My dad never knew it till he accidentally came home sober one night and got home early and saw me dressed like a girl and I had these little ribbons, I guess, and little curly things in my hair. In fact, my curls are screwed up tonight. My wife told me I had to fix my hair before I came up here, but I haven't got to that yet, so they all wasn't. But that don't make me alcoholic. But when I was 12 years old, my father beat me within an inch of my life, and I rode on my stomach from Knoxville, Tennessee to Southern California because I had big welts in my butt where he beat me with the buckle end of a belt. That don't make me alcoholic. Those things are all reasons that maybe we'll pick up a drink. What makes me alcoholic and sets me aside from all the rest of the people out there is that I have a physical allergy to alcohol. When I take the first drink of alcohol, it absolutely demands that I take the second drink of alcohol. And when I take the second drink of alcohol, I'm going to take the third or the fourth, and I'm not going to be done until the alcohol says I'm done. And Silkworth talks about that, and he calls it the phenomena of craving, and that's the best, single, most important piece of information I will ever have. And yet we have people come into Alcoholics Anonymous. We tell them, go read chapter 5 and do what it says. That's like telling a kid in kindergarten to go do algebra, for Christ's sake. You know, how can you do the algebra if you don't know how to do the addition and the multiplication and the division? God, this reminds me of some nights out there driving around. And all the other math, you know? How do you do that? That's the single most important piece of information I'll have. If I pick up a drink, I'm going to trigger the phenomenon of craving, and it's not going to go away, ever. That book tells me that I will always have a physical allergy to alcohol, coupled with that mental obsession. Now, later on in the book, it tells me, it gives a simple little thing. It says that when we cure the spiritual malady, the obsession will be removed. And we won't have to pick up a drink. See, if I can get rid of the obsessions of the mind that tell me, Harold, you need to have a drink. You've had a rough day. I used to do that. I can remember going to work And I did. I worked in the air conditioning business for a lot of years. I'm a sheet metal worker by trade, 37 years retired sheet metal worker. And I used to do a lot of work over in the aerospace industry plants over in El Segundo when Hughes Aircraft was booming and all those places. And I would go over there, and sometimes I'd get stuck, and I wouldn't get out of there at 3:30 like I should have. And so the freeways would get all jammed up, and I'd be pissed off because the job hadn't went well that day. And I'd probably call home and talk to my ex-wife, and things weren't going well there for sure. And so I would get on that freeway, and I'd have my first, and I'd get on that freeway, and it'd be stopped dead. Nobody moving. And I'd get on at Imperial Highway. And so now I would have my first major decision to make after work. I know I'm going to get off at Rosecrans, two off-ramps down. Am I going to go left and go into the flight room, or am I going to go right and go into the off-ramp liquor store? But I'm going to stop at one of those places. Now, I'm not going to get drunk, because I got drunk yesterday. I got my ass eaten out for it, and I'm not going to get drunk. I'm the alcoholic that never intentionally hurt anybody, and I can't tell you how many times I've sat in there, just like the guy in Chapter 3 that bangs on the bar and says, how did I get here again? I'm just like that guy. But I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to. We have a guy down in Southern California. His name is Father Terry, and Terry always talks about the alcoholic that we never get done. And see, that's what happens with me. I have that physical allergy to alcohol, and I can't get done. And the more I drink, the more I want. And I reach a sense of desperation. Finally, I'll drink into a blackout or a pass out, or somebody talked about, and then the projectile vomiting thing happening. Oh, God. And so that's how I lived my life. My first wife came into my office in 1986. And she says, I want a divorce. And I said, why? Don't you want to grow old together? I mean, I knew that we were having some problems and stuff, but holy cow. The companionship, we've got a beautiful home there in Cerritos. We've got the proverbial white picket fence. We've got boats. We've got horses. Kids are getting ready to get out of high school. Shit, man, we got it going on in spades. She goes, no. She goes, I want a divorce. She goes, it's not that I don't love you anymore. She goes, I can't stand to watch you kill yourself. What a profound statement that is. I didn't say anything about the Al-Anons before I started it either. And my wife told me not to tell any of my bad Al-Anon jokes, and I've got some of them. Most of them which were told to me by other Al-Anon members, by the way. I have so much respect for those of you that are members of Al-Anon that go to Al-Anon to try and learn about the disease of alcoholism, because I truly believe it is a family disease. And I respect you for not just saying, screw it, I'm out of here. Because I certainly wouldn't put up with it a lot of times. But I always have to crack up because alcoholics, we think we are so slick and we got all these books and all this spiritual teachings. And we have this little book called As Bill Sees It, you know. And Al-Anon has a book called Lois Remembers. I love people come up these podiums and tell these wonderful stories about their drinking. And hell, most of mine's conjecture. I don't know. I suited up. I showed up. I got drunk and I fell down and I got up and went to work the next day. That's kind of what happened. I mean, that's really my whole drunkalogue. I mean, some things happened in between. I went to jail a couple times. Went to the hospital a couple times. I can tell you about three defining little stories, and then I'm going to quit talking about my drinking. First one is in 1986, I went to, and this will describe that. If you're an alcoholic of my type, you'll understand every bit of it. I went to Mazatlan, Mexico in 1986. I had become a big-shot contractor. I had a six-figure income, a lot of folks working for me. I was pretty successful, and we used to go down there and go on these fishing trips. Now, I get sick when I get on a deep-sea boat, so what I would do is take the guys down to the docks, get them on the boat. I'd go back to the Pueblo Bonito or the Playa Mazatlan or wherever we were staying, and I'd just drink all day. That's where I met my wife, Carmi. In a bar. I met an Al-Anon in a bar. Hey, how about that, huh? Anyway, that's not the defining moment, though. And so I'd come back and I'd drink, and then I'd go back to the docks. And when I get back to the docks, the guys would be coming in with these beautiful marlin and dorado and sailfish, and I'd get up there and get me a picture taken next to one of them nice fish, you know. And make, look, because alcoholics, we got to look good. It's about looking good. I mean, when they came out with that Andre Agassi thing with the Canon cameras or something and said, image is everything, I go, yeah. Yeah, that's me. That's me. That's how alcoholics are. And so I get these pictures taken and stuff, and then I just get drunk. Well, I get real drunk in 1986 down there. I come home, and about somewhere around between 24 and 36 hours after I get home, I have this grand mal seizure. I'm still living in a home with my first wife. I was kind of in and out at that stage of the game. It's kind of like taking a hostage or not taking a hostage routine. And I had this really bad seizure. I chewed holes in my tongue. I did that flopping around, and I damn near died. I mean, it's a lot more serious than I like to let on. And they rushed me to Long Beach Memorial Hospital, and they ran all these tests for 3 days. Man, they did CAT scans and dog scans and PET scans and Jesus, every kind of scan you could think of. And at the end of 3 days, now while I'm in there, I got to tell you, I've got IVs hooked up on this IV card. I've got phenobarbital going into one arm, and I've got Dilantin going into the other arm. I've got guys bringing me little straws in with a little non-habit-forming cocaine, and then they're bringing me those bottles of gin and whiskey, the little airplane bottles. Because I figure, well, hell, I've got all the medication I need to keep me safe, so I might as well enjoy my stay while I'm here while they run all these tests. And I'm laying in bed drinking. Now, that's insane. That's absolutely insane to do that, and yet it seemed like the next indicated right step to me. My father was up on the next floor. I'd take my IV cards, leave the room, go up 2 flights of stairs, go visit him, talk about 100 miles an hour, come back down, and they go, Mr. Fox, you can't be leaving your room. And I go, why? I feel good. You know? I want to go home. And they're running these tests, and finally at the end of the third day they said, we think the reason you had that seizure is while you were in Mexico, you drank large amounts of alcohol and you ate a lot of shellfish, and the combination of the iodine in the shellfish and the alcohol is a deadly combination. I heard exactly what I needed to hear. I didn't eat shellfish for 4 years. Alcohol's not my problem. You know, and it really, when we get down to it, when I talk a little bit about recovery, our alcohol really isn't my problem. Selfishness and self-centeredness is my problem. That was just one of the stories. I played a lot of athletics after I got out of high school and through high school and stuff. And we decided we were going to put together this powerhouse slow pitch softball team. We called it Bad Company. And we all went out and bought those black shirts that looked like that Bad Company album that said Bad Company across the front of it, and wore shorts. And we would sit out in the parking lot and drink Tanqueray gin. We were all Tanqueray. That's the most disgusting shit you could ever think of, but that's what I like to drink. Whoop, you're not supposed to cuss from the podium, are you? Oh, well. Slipped again. Anyway, we'd drink this gin, and then we'd go out and play softball, and we just whipped everybody's butt. We were good. We were actually better than we knew we were. So, boy, you talk about 15 little budding alcoholics. Now, here's how I know we were all alcoholics. Most softball teams, after they play softball, go to a pizza place somewhere. That's kind of the deal. Women's teams, men's teams, mixed teams, it don't matter. And they'll go order 2 or 3 pizzas, and then they kind of do a little group conscience, and they'll say, should we get 2 pitchers or should we get 3 pitchers? And we'd walk in and just order 15 pitchers because it was 15 guys in the team. We'd all get our own pitcher, and we'd just sit there and drink. This one particular night, we had won the championship again at La Mirada Regional Park. We went over to the Shakey's on Imperial Highway. Little identification. Somebody else has been there. I hope you weren't a Bobby Sox softball player, because I owe you an amends if you were. And we walk in there, and we order our 15 pitchers, and we're sitting there, and we've got our trophy sitting in the middle of the table, you know, got to show that thing off and let everybody know who we are, by God. You know, the alcoholic can just amazing. The ego just gives birth and takes off in different directions sometimes. Anyway, we're sitting there, and my buddy says, and I guarantee you that this guy needs to be in here tonight. I hope some night I see him in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bob says to me, he says, you know what? It would be really cool. Now, you got a picture. This is back in the 70s when people ran around without their clothes on a lot. And he says, wouldn't it be really, really cool if we went out to the car, stripped off all of our softball clothes, and ran through this Shakey's naked with the trophy because the other team had shown up and they were sitting over a couple. And he says, we'll just run right across their table. So I said, that sounds good to me, Bob. You know, why not? So we go out, take all of our clothes off. And it, I mean, I don't know how many of you have played organized sports, but you wear these things called sanitary socks. You get your stirrups off and your sanitary and everything, and your jock and all. It takes a while to get undressed. So we get all, in a, especially in a little blazer, and we're in this thing trying to get these clothes off. And we're both drunk, and I'm sure people driving to see these two guys get naked and wonder, what in the hell's going on out there? So we get out of the car. We run back into the Shakey's. We've got our trophy. We head across the table. Well, while we were out there taking our clothes off, another championship team showed up in that Shakey's. It was an 8- and 9-year-old girls' Bobby Sox softball team. I understood pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization long before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of the most, when I think about that, now this should have put me in jail. That, I mean, they put, I mean, you register as a sex offender for that kind of stuff now, for Pete's sakes. You know, I mean, and the last thing I'll tell you about was the defining moment when my first wife said, that's it, you know, I've had enough. We used to go to the Long Beach Grand Prix every single year. And we would get up on these motorhomes and get up there. We'd take a big motorhome and we'd watch the races down there. Now, we would go down on Thursdays. The race isn't until Sunday, but we had to get the pit passes, go in and check out the cars. We had to get all the up-to-date information on what was going on. Really, what we had to do is go get drunk for 3 days for the race. The wives weren't allowed to come because they weren't interested in that kind of stuff. They came on Sundays. So here come the wives. We're all, I'm probably at about a .25 for maybe 72 hours at least. And they get down there. I beat red. I look like a lobster because I'm done being a runner and I've got my shirt on and stuff. And I'm on top of the motorhome. And the idea had come to me that there was a lot of beautiful women. It was a wonderful day outside. And so we created this little sign, and it said, show your, and it was a particular part of a woman's anatomy. And, you know, doing this up on top of the motorhome. And some women about back there where Julie's sitting, about two motorhomes over, complied and showed us that part of their anatomy. And I said, man, life is good. I never had it so good, you know. About 10 minutes later, one of them come back up on top of the motorhome with this little sign. This says, show your, and it was a little particular part of the man's anatomy. And in my case, a real little part. And not wanting to not be part of course, I dropped my drawers and complied and got up on the edge of the motorhome and did the little hoochie-coo thing. Buck-ass naked, and that was it. My wife said, that's it. I've had enough. You have embarrassed me for the last time. And she left. What I didn't tell you, while I was down in Mexico, and when I met Carmi, I had got her phone number. We kind of had a little spark. We didn't spark it too much because she had a roommate that stopped the spark, which really pissed me off. But that's another story for another time. And I had saved her phone number, so when I called her, and she moved out from Denver, she lived in Denver, Colorado, and we started this long-distance romance, and she came out, and she became my best drinking buddy. And from 1986 until April of 1990, we were going to trudge the road of happy destiny. And the disease, my disease, continued to progress. And it got worse, and it got worse, and it got worse. And finally, in April of 1990, it was the end of a long, long weekend. Been up a few days, and had finally got some sleep, and got up, and I was thinking about going to work. I own my own company, so I thought about it a lot, but I didn't show up too much. I absolutely destroyed a company because of my alcoholism. I absolutely destroyed a chance to probably be retired when I was 50 years old. Anyway, she said something to me that just absolutely stunned me. She says, aren't you going to go to work again today? And something happened that day to me that has never happened since that day, and I hope never happens again. I saw red. I turned about as red as Don's sweater down here. And it's like the bull that sees that's all he sees is that red thing. And I ran across the house, and I grabbed her by the neck, and I pushed her back over the kitchen sink, and I put my thumbs in her larynx, and I just started squeezing the air out of her. And I let her go, and then I spit in her face. Now, if you're new or fairly new here tonight, I hope you don't have to go to those lengths before you figure out that you might have a physical allergy to alcohol. is the most horrible thing I think I've ever done, and I hope I never, ever have to repeat that. I don't like to talk about it. The book says I should share in a general way, but I just know that it's important that I continue to remember, and Marion talked about it so well last night, that sometimes I can't recall with sufficient force events of even less than a month ago. I got a good forgetter. My sponsor told me, he says, the best working part of your brain is the forgetter part. You know, and it's easy for me to forget what it was like almost 16 years ago. That's going to be 16 years. It's 16 years ago this month that happened. I don't ever want to do that again. She's the most wonderful, precious thing in my life. And I damn near killed her because of a drug called alcohol. And she left me. Thank God she moved over to Phoenix, Arizona to be with her parents. And I went up and moved up. I moved back home with my mother. So I did a quick little inventory. I'm 6 days before my 44th birthday. And I've got 2 children from my first marriage that want nothing to do with me. I've got 1 grandchild I can't visit. My second wife has just left me. And I've just moved back in with my mommy. I was pretty sure I took the second half of step 1 before I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I knew my damn life was pretty unmanageable. If you're a big shot contractor and you just moved back in with your mommy, your life can't be too damn good. But I didn't know I was powerless over alcohol. And thank God for people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for people in hospitals and institutions committees that made me read those Roman numeral pages to understand what the true meaning of step 1 really was. If it hadn't been for that, I don't think I'd be here tonight. I really don't. Because I thought, no human power is going to relieve my alcoholism if you're the type of alcoholic that I am. The book always talks about alcoholics of our type. And when I read that book, that's the type of alcoholic I am, so I just need to follow those dictates. So anyway, I get my journey to recovery started then. I called a place down in Newport Beach. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'd heard about rehabs. I'd had people telling me since I was 21 years old, man, you don't drink like normal people. You know, you need to take a look at your drinking. And then I thought, well, who the hell wants to? A guy down in Oceanside named Cliff R., I always like what he says when his wife tells him, don't you think you've had a few too many? He says, no, I think you've had a few too few. You know, and that's the way I felt about it. And I identify, that's one of the things I identify with. That's the kind of stuff why it's so important. I'll tell you another thing that happened to me. I had another little epiphany while I was up here, and it happened to me Thursday night in a meeting. And I usually don't like to be a name dropper, Jeanette, but I heard her share in a meeting about our triangle that we used to have. And she talked about the sides of the triangle and how we have the fellowship, which is what we're doing tonight. This is the fellowship. This is great stuff. One alcoholic with another, you know. But she talked about how there's a difference between the fellowship and the program. And I believe there's a power in both. And then, of course, the right side of the triangle, which is our service, which is the secret ingredient we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started learning all that stuff real early. But I call this place in Newport Beach, and they said, we have a bed for you if you want to come down. Just bring us a check for $30,000. And I said, well, if I had $30,000, I wouldn't need your damn help. So I hung up on them, and that's how arrogant I was, you know. I mean, even though I desperately needed somebody's help, anybody's help. I called around and I found a place to land down in the desert. It was just the place that I needed to land. I had enough insurance money to be able to take care of it. And even though my parents paid for it, my father was still alive. Both my parents have passed on since. Anyway, I went down there, and as I walked through the door, I remember them handing me a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me if I would read that book, and they said something that I haven't heard since anywhere. I hear people say in AA, the answers are in the book. The answers are in the book. They said the questions were in the book. Think about it. Where was I selfish? Where was I self-centered? Where was I self-seeking? Where was I frightened? Where did I create disturbances in other people's lives? It's all right there in black and white. And I read that book, and I have been accused. I used to be offended when people say, he's one of those book thumpers. Now I'm proud of being a book thumper. I'm glad I did, because it's allowed me to stay around here, because I've learned about a real simple thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Simple but not easy. The price has to be paid. It's the destruction of self-centeredness. And I'm still pretty selfish and self-centered, but I have learned so much because of Alcoholics Anonymous. While I was in that treatment center, you folks started coming in there every night. Every single night you came in there. And it was absolutely incredible. The first night they said, we're going to go to a meeting. And I go, what meeting? I ain't going to no damn meeting. I'm the defiant one sitting back there like this. I ain't going to your damn meetings, you know. And they said, well, pack your shit and leave, you know. And I thought, well, okay, I guess I'll go to the meeting. So I go to this meeting, and this H&I panel comes in. And they shared the message of hope, you know, but the attraction and not the promotion. Now, I will be honest, two of these women were just drop-dead gorgeous. They were like as beautiful as Marion and my wife, you know, just drop-dead gorgeous women. And a guy, and I wanted what they had, not the guy. But you know what? And I'm being kind of cute about it. But the honest to God's truth is that I knew that night, based on what they told me, that I was probably alcoholic. It allowed me to go back to my room, pick up that book, and start to understand that I had a disease called alcoholism. And thank God I know that today. By having a disease called alcoholism has made it acceptable for me to do the other 11 and a half things I had to do. Simple little things. It made it acceptable to have a disease. You know, people tell me, I don't think alcoholism is a disease. And I said, well, I will defend your right to have your opinion. I just don't agree with it. I said, you know, if you had diabetes, would you be ashamed of that? Well, no. And I said, well, alcoholism is a disease. Make no difference. There's about 10% of the people have it, whether you like it or not. And so I started this journey to recovery, or if you will, the big book comes alive. I'm a big fan of a couple of guys named Joe and Charlie. I've done a lot of book studies with them. I believe in what those two men do 100%. And as I went through this, started to go through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had some wonderful, wonderful experiences. I got over to the third step, and I honestly didn't think that I'd always known there was a God, but I did not know that I probably had turned my life over to God anyway, because He had kept me alive. And I'll guarantee you that there's hundreds of times that I should have been dead and never died. So I'm sure that God was always watching me. I never knew that, you know. So when I turned my will over to God, which was my thoughts, things started to change, but not right away. See, I got down on my knees, I took this third step prayer, and I got back off on my knees, and not a thing changed. And they said, well, the change occurs through the actions you take in steps 4 through 9. That's why we need you old timers in here, so you can keep tricking newcomers like me into getting doing all the rest of the stuff, you know. And so we started to go through and take the steps, and I identified a lot of resentments and stuff I had. And I'm not going to go through every single one of the steps tonight, because I want to talk about a little bit. You know, the book also says that our personal adventures before and after. I want to tell you about what it's like to live sober for almost 16 years. I had a big misconception about what it was going to be like to live sober 16 years. I know we've got some new people. I saw some of you stand up. I thought life was just going to skip the light fantastic and be happy, joyous, and free, man. And it ain't been like that. You know, there's been some things that have happened. And we've had some good times and we've had some bad times. I heard a gentleman share the other day. He says, there's two kinds of days. He says, I have good days and I have great days. He says, now the good days are the days that I get up and I ask God to direct my thinking, and I consider my plans for the day, which is what our book tells us to do. And I go out, and he says, and everything goes just perfect. He says, that's a good day. He says, then I have great days. He says, that's when I ask God to direct my thinking, and I consider my plans for the day. Not one damn thing goes right. He says, but I don't pick up a drink. He says, that's a great day. Now, I've had some great days in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was about 2.5 years sober, I was running for president of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know nobody else has ever done that. And of course, what I didn't know then, but I know now, is that every single person in this room is the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. Old timer took me aside and says, no, I'm already president. You can run for VP. Anyway, I was doing everything that I could. And one of the things that I had decided after I got sober in this treatment center is that I would do anything that I got asked to do in AA. Anything. Because of the way I felt when I left there. I mean, I was still nuts. But I knew that something had happened when I left there. I knew that the message had been this merit message. The message. The one that's right here in the front of this podium. And so I started doing service work, and I found, discovered the secret of service. You know, 95% of the work in here is done by 5% of the people. And look at all you guys. Here you all are, and you're all smiling. You know, I love people that do service work. It's just, you're an attraction to me. And I started doing that. Well, I went back to this treatment center. I'd been asked to go back and share my story. And after we go, down in the low desert anyway, when we used to always go for coffee after the meetings. That just was a thing that we did. And we went out for coffee, and I got a phone call. And they said, Harold, would you come over to Desert Hospital? There's a man over here whose wife has just died. And he's 4 years sober, and he wants to go have a drink. And I learned how to say, you bet. So I took off, and I went over to the hospital, and his wife had a brain aneurysm and died at 31 years old or something like that. And I sat down, and I talked with him for I don't know how long, 3-4 hours it seems to me. And I'm not even sure. I can't tell you tonight one thing that was said other than I'm pretty sure we discussed the fact that drinking alcohol would not be the solution that night. And I'm sure that God sent me over there for a reason. I don't believe anything happens in God's world by mistake. I believe it. Every single one of us are here tonight for a reason. Don't know what it is. Don't ask me. But I know that we're supposed to be right where we're at all times. And I was there that night. And I went home and I went to bed. And I always feel good. See, that's the thing I like about doing this. I'll sleep peacefully tonight. I'm scared to death when I come up here tonight. I sweat like a whore in church, for Pete's sakes. But I'll feel good tonight. And I felt good that night when I went home. And I went home that night. And I got a phone call from my mother that my father had been rushed to the hospital in Long Beach. And thank God that I'm married to somebody that's also in recovery. And I said, I don't know what to do. And she says, you need to drive to Long Beach, and I'm going with you. And we drove to Long Beach, and what had happened is my father had had a massive heart attack, and he had died. Now, you know, it was okay. I mean, it was a big deal to me then because my father was a hero of mine. You know, I actually was able to go back and make amends to my father, even though he had ended up on my resentment list of something that had happened when I was 12 years old. That's why I think it's so critical. Here goes another opinion, that we get newcomers and we take them through the steps now, not a year from now. We can always repeat them. Once they're detoxed and they're ready to go, let's get it busy. Anyway, because of that, I got to go back and make amends to a lot of people I've made amends to are dead now. Anyway, he died, and I had because of doing service and being involved in the fellowship of AA and in the service structure, I had been to a lot of funerals and stuff, and I'd seen how you guys do funerals. You do celebrations of life. My sponsor told me, AA is a program of living, not dying. And he taught me, that man has taught me more about how to, he hasn't taught me about the steps, honestly. Jim's never taught you a lot about the steps, Michael. But he's taught me more about how to live life comfortably inside my own skin and about how to live like normal folk live out there. And so he says, you just suit up and you show up and you do the best you can. So I asked my mother if I could participate in my father's eulogy. And she goes, well, you're not going to read any of that old AA stuff, are you? And I said, no, Mom, I would never do that to you. So I took the 12 and 12, and I read the 11-step prayer. Because that prayer is a beautiful prayer, and it was written long. AA didn't think about that. You know, sometimes I think we give ourselves too much credit for all the stuff that we've stolen and put in a book. Anyway, I won't go into it. That's another opinion. Anyway, we buried my father, and I buried him with dignity and grace. That's the bottom line. That's how I live my life. I get to live my life with dignity and grace today because of you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to live my life today with accountability and responsibility because of you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And those are lessons I learned from the old-timers in AA. And the newcomers are still teaching me stuff. I'm learning stuff from new people, too. You know, everybody here is a teacher. Sometimes some people teach us the right things to do, and sometimes they teach us the wrong things to do. But they just teach us. So we went about our life, and I was still running for president of AA, and I finally got away from that, and I thought, well, hell, somewhere in here it says I need to become a bleeding deacon or an elder statesman, and I guess maybe Bob could be an elder statesman, man, but I haven't got there yet. I'm still out there. I'm still stirring a pot. I'm like Tony back there. He's a pot stirrer. I guarantee you that guy. Anyway, we go through, and things are going really, really well for us. And my brother was at the top of my resentment list, him and my sister-in-law. And every time I write a resentment list, she still appears at the top of the thing. But I went back to work for him, and I worked for him for 11 years, and I retired. And I still don't like the way he runs his business. But I did it his way, because it was his business. That's what my sponsor told me. What he does is none of your business. It's his business. Sponsorship has been so, so valuable to me. 6 years sober, things are going pretty good. My wife and I have started to get some stuff again. I mean, when we came here with a four-drawer cardboard dresser. And that was it. And a 85 Suburban with 186,000 miles on it that had a few whiskey bumps in it. And we started to get some stuff, and you know how it is, alcoholics, we like to have stuff, and then after we get some stuff, we got to get some more stuff. And so we're starting to get stuff, and things are going okay, and we got some stuff, and I'm working for my brother. I've got a pretty good position with him. I'm running some good construction jobs. I'm actually out at the Riverside General Hospital, which was probably one of the largest buildings built in Riverside County in the last 20 years. And I get a call from the office, and they said, you need to call Carmelita. She's absolutely hysterical. We're not sure what's going on, but there's something wrong at home. My brother was on vacation. I had his cell phone. I never carried a cell phone. But that day, I had a... This is 1986. Not everybody carried cell phones back then. I had a cell phone. Now, is that odd or is that God? See, that's what I always ask people. Is that odd or is that God? So many things have happened in my life... You know, I used to say, it can't be coincidence. There's no such thing. I just think that's God doing his work anonymously. So I get the cell phone, and I call my wife. And she says, what I can get out of her is that she was going to get our grandson from school. And she used to always stop and pick up our other grandson and take the youngest one because he loved to go get his little brother. And she went over to pick him up, and our daughter brought him out. And he let go of her hand and dashed across the alley, and a car came through. And hit him. And killed him. He was 2.5 years old. And he had given me my 6-year cake that year. Up at a place called Lost Heads Ranch. Now, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink that. Didn't have a drink that day, nor any day since that day. And we buried that little boy with dignity and grace. Because of you people. And because of some principles, and because of some ethics, and because we've learned how to be accountable and responsible here, and to take the next indicated right step. People immediately were at our door. A gal who I think you guys had probably speak up here, who is a member of my home group, and I think she spoke at this conference maybe 3 or 4 years ago, by the name of Donna E., was in our house before I could get there. My wife's sponsor was there before I could get there. My sponsor came to the viewing. My sponsor doesn't do funerals, but he came to the viewing. And you guys rocked us, and you loved us, and you held us, and you took care of us. A couple of funny things happened as a result of that. And I shouldn't probably try to make light of this, but it seemed funny to me. And I'm going to try to offer you some advice here. If somebody close to you in your life dies... And we always take food. Isn't that what we always do when we go to the house? We're not sure, because none of us know what to say. We take food. For Pete's sakes, don't take chicken. Because everybody brought chicken. I ate chicken for 4 days, man. I felt like I was going to cluck, for Christ's sake. The little guy that I sponsored came over and sat on my couch named Tim. Little redheaded guy. Didn't have much to say. He just knew that I was hurt. He knew that he needed to be there, but he didn't know what to do. He just came just to be there, just to sit. And he says, Harold, is there anything I could do for you? And I said, yeah. You could take me over to the Fat Burger. Let me get a big double cheese with like extra cholesterol, extra grease, and extra triglycerides, some bacon. Get me the hell away from this chicken, you know? we had a memorial service for our grandson. Probably 300 people attended. We didn't have a lot of money, but we had enough money to get by, and things were getting better. And our kids really did. We're struggling. They didn't have a lot of money. And, you know, burials are expensive. As people filed out, they put checks in my pocket, and they put money in my pocket. One guy put a $5 bill in my pocket, and I guarantee you, I knew this guy from meetings. He didn't have enough money to eat on that night, probably. And it was just enough money to take care of everything that needed to be taken care of. See, God takes care of the people that take care of Him. God takes care of those of us that go out and do His work, I believe. And he was such a special little boy, and I was saving him a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, too. I remember coming home one time on a Friday. I used to go out of town and stay at my mother's house for 3 or 4 days at a time, and I would try to take care of Mom after Dad had died, and it was more convenient for work, too. And but I came home one Friday, and Joshua was in the house, and I said, come on over here, Joshua, and give Grandpa some love. And he was used to watching this Homer Simpson thing on the TV. And he leans over and he goes, take a picture of my butt. Remember that? 2.5 years old of this kid's been, I think. Yeah. I'll have you down make a coffee at my home group, bud. And, he was just a delight in our lives. But, you know, life goes on. I just don't think God takes. I just think God receives. I just think God receives. I think he was done. Joshua had fulfilled what he needed to do. But I never ever thought about burying a grandkid or my own kid. You know, I almost lost a daughter when she was 18 years old. She was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And what I did is I went out and drank behind that. And every day she'd go have chemotherapy, I'd go drink. Good father, huh? You know what? I haven't been a great father or probably a great husband, but I'm a damn good grandpa. A damn good grandpa. And I'm becoming a better husband and a better, I don't have any parents left, but I was a better son because of Alcoholics Anonymous. That same year, though, in 1996, the phone started ringing. See, God knows what we need to do. And a guy that I dearly loved, he was one of my heroes, he's dead now, him and his wife, Wes and Aline Manuel. Those of you that used to live in the San Fernando Valley knew them. And Wes called me right after that funeral, and he says, you have a commitment to speak in Redlands, don't you? Thursday night. And I said, well, yeah. And he goes, but you're going to send one of your babies, aren't you? And I go, yeah. You know, because I thought I needed to be home with Carm and the family. He says, you have a commitment to the Las Vegas Young People's Roundup the following weekend, too, don't you? And I go, well, yeah. And he goes, but you're going to blow that off, too, aren't you? And I go, yeah. And he says, and he didn't yell at me. It's the first time he never yelled at me. Because he used to, and his wife really yelled at me. And he says, Harold, let me share my experience with you. He says, I've buried 2 wives in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time I did, I thought I ought to pull in the reins and maybe not do as much AA and do more things with the family. He says, and both times, he says, I was the most miserable SOB in the world. He says, keep your AA commitments. They're what got you here. You know? I went to Ireland in 1996, same year that Joshua died. I'm of Irish descent. I'd always wanted to go to Ireland, but I thought I'd never, ever get there. Hell, I never thought I'd get out of a pair of dirty pajamas and quit peeking out of the blinds in Long Beach. But because of service, I met these people that were involved in doing service, and they said, we're going to put together a group of people who are going to go to Ireland. And so we started saving our penny nickels and dimes, and we ended up, it was the 50th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous in Ireland. And we were in Killarney for the 50th anniversary. We went over there with 40 alcoholics, 2 Al-Anons, no fistfights for 12 days. There was one couple that decided they were going to have a crappy time at LAX, and they had a crappy time for 12 days. That's their business, you know. You know, I'm not going to deny anybody the right to be miserable. So anyway, we got over there, and we had that time of our life, the absolute time of our life. And I've always wondered about this thing called Step 11, you know, and because my sponsor always tells me, Harold, keep it simple. Don't try to complicate stuff. He told me, he says, you're the only guy I know could screw up a 2-car funeral, you know, because I think too much. That's the problem with alcoholics. If they let me change the book, I'd change that part in Chapter 3, which says the problem, the alcoholic is that, you know, the abnormal drinkers is the drinking. I'd change that. Everywhere the word drinking, I'd put thinking in there. And so we got over there, and on Saturday or Sunday, on the closing day of the convention, we were staying at this hotel in the National Forest just outside of Killarney. And I opened up the drapes early in the morning. And there was a little mist, like a fog, you know, that tule fog you guys have up here. It was just kind of laying along the ground, and you could look across over the tule fog, and there was a lake out there, and there was an island out on the lake, and on top of the island where there was a castle. And I just sat there, and I just kind of looked at that, and I thought how good God was. And then about four red-tailed deer ran through the meadow. You know, Chuck Chamberlain used to always say he never had it so good. You know, and I have to tell you, I never had it so good. And I started to learn about just the goodness in life. My friends Marta and Eddie came up here with me this weekend to be here and be with me, to support me. And we're going to go over to the sequoias tomorrow afternoon and go up and look at a couple of the trees in the snow. I'm an idiot, I know, but Eddie's driving and he's a lot smarter than I am. And he's an Al-Anon, so I turn my will and my life over to care of Al-Anons all the time. What the hell, you know? I know. And it'll all work out exactly the way it's supposed to work out. Carm wanted me to tell you guys a couple of stories about my H&I work. And man, I don't ever go over 62 minutes, but you better have a 77 in there because I'm going to talk for a couple more minutes. I don't believe that anybody gets sober after a guy's been talking for an hour. Your ass starts to hurt and everybody wants to get up and leave. At least that's the way I am. In fact, if you're done and I'm not, go ahead and leave. It don't bother me none, you know. It really does. Well, I'm going to tell you a couple more things and I'm going to sit down. I started going into hospitals and institutions with a friend of mine named Rick T. that lives in Long Beach. It's real active in Orange County and Harbor area. And I love Rick to death. And I wish he could be here with me this weekend, because this is kind of a culmination of a dream of mine to share at an H&I conference. It really is. We used to go to this lockdown ward, Ward 416, a Metropolitan State Hospital. And it's where they have the criminally insane. And a lot of those people are in bad shape. You know, they're really, really sick people. And we would go in there, and we had two techs that worked on the ward, and both these ladies were sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, one of them was the doctor on the wing. And we would go into this place, and I went in there for about 4 years, and it was this conference room. And when we first started going there, the patients took their drugs, their meds, about 30 minutes before we'd go in. We'd go in at 7:30. They'd take their meds at 7, so they were like this. And we were carrying the message to each other. We were getting kind of tired of that. A lady named Angie T. used to go in with us all the time. I think Angie's got 49 years now, just a dear, dear, sweet friend of mine. And so then we just said, look, why don't you let them have their meds a half hour later, and we'll come in a half hour earlier. So they'd get their meds at 8, and we'd come in at 7. And boy, was that interesting. We'd have guys get up, just be talking, and, you know, and then they just get up and just go over in the corner and pee right in the corner, you know. And you guys have all been there, and you've all heard these stories. But every month I would look, and on this one wall there was a picture. And it was a still life. It was just a picture of a duck, a mallard duck, sitting on the water with a piece of tape over its head. And for years, at least two years, I looked at this picture, wondering what the psychological significance or the social redeeming value of this picture was, you know. But to have an alcoholic ego, I'm not about to ask anybody about it. Especially, you know, the people that work there, hell, they may want to lock me up. If there must be something, if you have the wrong answer, you get banned and you get to stay. And I don't want to stay there. One night I get enough courage, I think, I'll ask one of the patients. The keen alcoholic mind goes to work. Because this guy had been in there for a long time. He'd been in there as long as I'd been coming there. And I said, Gene, what's that mean over there, that picture on the wall with the duck on it, with the tape over its head? And he looks at me like I'd lost my mind. He says, for Pete's sakes, that's duct tape. When the student's ready, the teacher will appear, you know. Then I'm going to tell you another one that my Al-Anon had told me not to tell you. But I'm going to try to clean it up a little bit. We go to a place also called Harborview Hospital. It's for medically indigent people that have problems that also suffer from grave and emotional and mental disorders. I had the privilege of seeing a guy walk out of there and take a 6-year cake one night in a meeting that I go to. So, you know, that stuff's still worthwhile. But most of them live in group homes if they can ever get out of this place. But we would go there and talk to them, you know, because that's what we were asked to do. You know, we go because of our ninth tradition, because somebody's formed a committee and said, would you please come here and serve us? And so that's what we go do. And so we went there to serve them. And I go there with my friend Rick one night and a couple of us, and they asked me to share first. And so I share for a few minutes. And you know how sometimes you're talking with somebody and they're kind of nodding, you know, like they're kind of identifying with you. And this guy's, I'm watching this guy, and as I'm talking, man, he's just like a little doggy in the back of a 56 Chevrolet. He's just really identifying, I think. And so I get done sharing, and he goes, let's just go outside just for a minute. I want to talk to you. I kind of looked at Rick, and I said, I'll be right back. So we go out, and I think I've really carried the message. As I'm walking out that door, a bunch of little heralds took off across the floor, a little alcoholic egos, you know, and I'm thinking, God, what a great speaker you are. And I walk out, and the guy says, would you like to come back up to my room and watch me masturbate? I mean, it's from the good, the bad, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, that's not, I'm not trying to, that's just something that's happened to me. It's not, it's just a story. You know, I just, and I've had so many great, great memories. I served on the service committee. I went back into the meeting, by the way. I served on the service committee for the 1995 International Convention in San Diego. What a blessing that was. I went to the International in Minnesota, and then I went to Toronto last year. And what a tremendous thing that is. I don't have the words to explain to you what it's like to sit in a stadium with 50 or 60,000 people and watch them walk the flags in from all the countries that are represented in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked on the Palm Springs Convention, and one of the things we did is we sent money over to Russia to get the book translated, and we got sent back some scrolls in parchment with the steps and traditions in Russia. You know, those are the kind of things that I value in my life today. Those are the kind of most beautiful things that have happened to me. Ivan and his wife came down and renewed mine and Carm's wedding vows when we were 2 years over. And I love you very much for that. I'll always love you, Ivan. It's those kind of things that bring special memories to me. I just got back from Indianapolis. I was asked to speak at the Speedway group back there. It was their 60th anniversary a couple of weeks ago. And I looked on the map and I said, God, that's only 300 miles from Akron. I'd really like to go over to Akron. The guy said, hell, if you're stupid enough to stay in Indiana in the winter, you can stay at my house as long as you want. And I said, okay. So I went back there and I stayed for a week. And we went over there. The night I spoke at the Speedway group, we had a sobriety countdown, just like we did tonight. They gave a book to the newcomer. The newcomer had one day. The old-timer had 48 years. So it's just kind of like about what we had here tonight. And I got the idea, and I leaned over to Joe, and I said, let's grab that newcomer and take him to Akron with us, because I know he don't have a job. Hell, newcomers don't have a job. And we went down. I said, what are you going to be doing tomorrow? He says, I'm going to be busy. You know how we are when we're new. We're busy. I said, well, you're not that busy. And we'll pick you up at 7. We picked this kid up, and we took him over there. We took him into Sue Winda's bedroom, which is Dr. Bob's daughter. We knelt down, and we took the third step together. We took him over to the gravesite where Ann and Bob are buried, and we put our chips on the gravestone. We took him over to the Mayflower Hotel, and we put him on the telephone. I said, now this is what Bill did when he called Doc Reverend Walter Tonks to get sober instead of walking into the bar. And then we took him down to the intergroup offices in Akron where they have the original Silkworth letter, and they have the original Bible that was used at King's School. Unbelievable weekend. He called me after I got home, and he said, what I did with you men was a life-changing experience. And I talked to him tonight before I came up here. He's 37 days sober today. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about for me. I'm going to close. I have some cards with me. I don't know if I have enough. I heard a guy named John A. from Dallas, Texas speak when I was 4 years sober. And it was that night that I knew that I hadn't truly taken the third step. But John put on these cards something that I thought was very profound. And it really probably tells you how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, there is the love of a husband for his wife. And there is the love of a child for its mother. But there is no love like the love of one alcoholic sharing with another. That's what this whole thing is all about, is Bob and I sitting down, Marta and I sitting down, Michael and I sitting down and talking this thing out and trying to figure out a way that we can stay sober one day at a time. And now I'm going to sing. But we're going to sing. All of us are going to sing together. Okay? There's only about three or four words. The words are, oh, thank you, God. And it's sang to the song of O Tannenbaum that you sing at Christmas time. And if you would help me, I would surely appreciate it. And we'll close this meeting with the man who's done the source of our power. Oh, thank you, God. 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 Peace.